State leaders react to terrorism in Israel. Another electric vehicle battery plant in Indiana. Plus a first meeting on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 13th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, conflict in Israel following attacks by a Palestinian militant group has left more than 1,000 people injured and hundreds more dead. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Violet Comber-Weiland reports some of Indiana's top politicians are showing their support for Israel, which announced a full siege of the Gaza Strip Monday.
The attacks come following a long-standing dispute between Israeli and Palestinian residents in the region. On X, formerly Twitter, Governor Eric Holcomb called the attacks, injuries, and deaths that have resulted during fighting tear-jerking. He added he is praying for peace and that Israeli citizens have his support. Also on X, U.S. Senator Todd Young called the attacks on Israel appalling. U.S. Senator Mike Braun called for the country to stand strong with Israel during these conflicts. On a national level, President Joe Biden also condemned the attacks, saying his administration's support for Israel is unwavering.
What could be the political and policy consequences in the U.S. of the violence in Israel? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Lindsay Yerdoti, editor for Axios Local. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, first and foremost, the first, second, fifth, thousandth most important thing is the lives that have been lost and the innocent lives that are still in peril.
Absolutely.
This is not to diminish that in any way. But here at home, from its effect on who's going to run the U.S. House of Representatives to support for Ukraine, which you wouldn't think is connected, but is becoming connected. How wide-ranging might the ripple effects of this be?
I think it has the potential for being very wide-ranging. I mean, when you see the inability of Congress to deal with any of the issues that are so crucial for Israel, for the Ukraine, and for this country, I mean, you've got You basically have those Republicans in the House fiddling while the Middle East is burning. We can't even pass a resolution supporting Israel because they can't govern until they get a speaker. And we can't provide the aid that we need to provide. And, you know, you look at that and then you look at that goofball senator, Republican senator from Alabama who won't let the generals, even the generals, six of them have expertise in the Middle East and they can't be confirmed. I mean, we're at a shutdown position. There aren't adequate words to describe how bad Hamas's conduct was in this. There aren't words for it. But we had a peaceful, relatively peaceful demonstration downtown from Palestinians not supporting Hamas, but talking about legitimate Palestinian problems. And you had others supporting Israel, which is also absolutely fine. And then you have Shreve demagoguing about that in a desperate attempt, I guess, to gain some votes in his unsuccessful campaign for mayor. You know, I mean, he's saying that they shouldn't have been given a permit. You don't need a permit. And he doesn't even understand that the circle is state land, not city land. And by the way, the First Amendment guarantees people the right to peacefully protest no matter how much you disagree with what they do. So it's having effects already. I just hope that the Republicans in Congress can get their act together so that we can provide the aid that Israel needs and the support that Israel needs. But I'm not confident that's happening anytime soon.
It does seem like the most immediate impact is shining a brighter light on what's going on in the House where Republicans are struggling to come up with a new speaker, because we already knew, and there was already going to be a sort of sprint to try and figure this out, certainly. But then this happens, and Israel needs aid, and we can't get it to them presently under the rules of the House. And how does that maybe change some, does it change anything in trying to figure out who the next speaker is going to be?
It's been hard for years to tell what was going to break this hold or break this dysfunction. And if it's not this, then I don't know what else is on the list. We're kind of at the end of the list. This has got to push that. But it's seen, Scalise just stepped down, just removed his name from nomination because Jim Jordan's supporters, of which there's like five, did exactly what they did when they took McCarthy out. 95% of the caucus wants to go one direction, and the other 5% doesn't, so we're doing what the 5% want. And that's why America on both sides looks incredibly dysfunctional, and that has a consequence. I know it's like, it's fun to just kind of laugh at it when Donald Trump's taking his shots, and it's fun to just poke fun or kick D.C. while it's down. Well, the rest of the world sees that. And when you have every hot spot on the planet that we've, for 80 years since we reorganized this world the way it is organized for on purpose, and that purpose was security and safety and prosperity for America more than anybody. And when you take your eye off that ball, these aren't just theoretical things I'm saying. This is what Putin is saying. He's saying, no, we're paying attention to the dysfunction of the American political system. Oh, okay, well, that's why China's going to Taiwan. That's why Hamas and Gaza's in Israel. That's why Putin, of course, is in Ukraine.
And who knows what the
And who knows what's coming next. Yeah. So, I mean, you've got the small ball of electing a speaker matters. And getting out of this endless cycle of complete dysfunction that Donald Trump comes in and praises Hezbollah. We needed one more thing. So are we on Iran's side now as a Republican Party, or what are we doing?
Yeah. Looking at the speaker's race, because I do think that's the most immediate impact in terms of trying to get something out of Congress. They're talking about potentially expanding the powers of an interim speaker, which Patrick McHenry is right now. Scalise just pulls out. Jordan's camp seems entrenched. Is this the sort of thing that might be able to cajole them off of that?
You would think so, or you would have thought so. As I've said before on this show, I think our beacon in these sorts of things or our guide is history and precedent. And we look back and see how these sorts of conundrums have been resolved in the past. But the rules of engagement are just so fundamentally different now because of the intransigence of some of these very small factions within the Republican Party. I don't know. I mean, to them, this is sort of a badge of honor. The more dysfunction they can bring upon the house in which they serve or seemingly the country, the better. So I don't know what the answer is. So you're left, it's an interesting vacuum because of the dysfunction in Washington. You have states trying to, and of course, they constitutionally have little ability to do much, but that hasn't stopped Ron DeSantis this week from promising the harshest sanctions against Iran, never mind that nobody has formally made a connection, although certainly there is that speculation about Hamas and its backing in any tangible way by Iran. But that hasn't stopped Ron DeSantis from promising state action. So, you know, in the absence of real action, you get a lot of politicians who aren't in a position to do much trying to make hay on all sides of the issue, it seems.
There's also the question with the speaker's race now is if Republicans are increasingly at an impasse, is it up to a few Republicans in districts that Joe Biden won to go to Democrats and say, maybe not Hakeem Jeffries for speaker, although obviously that's what Democrats would want, but is there a Republican that you will all vote for and a few of us will vote for and that's the way we move forward? Is that getting increasingly likely?
Probably. I mean, I think we've already started to see some reports of that. Now, whether or not it works out, who knows? I mean, because Democrats were mad that, you know, okay, well, we were promised this. We saw this with McCarthy. Like, it just doesn't... Democrats ended up not...
There's got to be a commitment that if they do that, they do it over and over and over.
Yeah.
Because of the way the rules are.
And they want something.
It's a question of trust on all sides. Yeah. I don't know that a lot of that exists at the moment.
Well, right. So I think it'll come down to that. And I don't know. I mean, to John's point, like you would think, like maybe that's the way we'll go. But I mean, I don't know that any of us know
which way
it's going to go. Yeah, we don't. We just truly don't know what it's going to take to get a speaker.
To repeal the rule that allowed Gantz to take McCarthy out.
I mean, that's part of the whole thing for electing a new speaker is a commitment to keeping that rule in place where one member can trigger
the motion. Well, that's what's mostly destructive here. That has to go.
Well, and the problem with compelling everybody to stay good on that deal is the facts change. the decisions you're making change, the policy decisions, the things the Republican majority is passing change, and what do the Democrats do in that scenario?
Yeah.
Well, and I think if a few Democrats agree to it, then they're going to, the rest of the Democratic Party in Congress is going to be mad at them. Be like, why did you do that? You know, like, there's
I mean, Democrats so far have been incredibly aligned on this. But
if you still have the one-person challenge, you're back to square one again.
Mm-hmm. That's true. All right. Stellantis, the parent company of Jeep and Chrysler, announced this week it plans to build a second electric vehicle battery plant in Kokomo. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Adam Yahya Reyes reports this comes as the United Auto Workers presses the company to protect union jobs in the shift to EVs.
The first Kokomo battery plant is set to begin production by early 2025, and the second is slated to open by 2027. In total, both plants are expected to employ about 2,800 people. The plants are part of a separate company formed by a partnership between Stellantis and Samsung SDI. Such joint venture battery plants are a sore spot for the United Auto Workers Union. The UAW is pushing Stellantis, as well as Ford and General Motors, to meet certain contract demands through a nearly month-long strike campaign. Several demands seek to address concerns about the electric transition. The three companies have resisted making their joint venture plants part of the same UAW national contract that covers most of their current hourly manufacturing workers. GM agreed on Friday to make its joint venture battery plants part of the national contract. The union wants Stellantis and Ford to do the same.
Michael Ryan, we haven't talked much about the UAW strike yet on this show because it hasn't hit home squarely in Indiana yet. That might come now at any day, as the UAW announced. They're no longer going to wait until the end of the week to announce where they're striking next. It could happen any day, any time. So I imagine we will be talking about that at some point. But on this issue, with Stellantis announcing a second plant in Kokomo, Brad Chambers, candidate for governor, sent out a statement celebrating this, very recent former Secretary of Commerce. Can announcements like this one, big jobs announcements, this is good news, undoubtedly. Can that be a boost for his campaign specifically?
Sure, especially in the communities where he's bringing them, or where these jobs are being brought. He was Secretary of Commerce when the first big battery plant was announced. This is the second announcement, and these don't happen overnight, so presumably this happened mostly on his watch when he was the Secretary of Commerce. So, yeah, I mean, it's his niche, right? It's what he's running on. This is what I do. So to be able to, you know, show a tangible result in that, what's interesting is the UAW strike, the arguments for the strike that it requires fewer workers to build an electric car. We always go through this as industries transition, and Biden's in a weird position where he's, like, pushing it hard, but also trying to protect the union jobs, understandably. But the answer to, well, what do we do when it takes half as many people to build a car? It's like, well, you go work at the battery plant. That didn't exist before, right? Yeah. So it just creates this ecosystem in the economy.
Which is why the battery plants have been such a focus of this UAW strike. On the topic of Brad Chambers, we've talked many times about this Republican gubernatorial campaign, and with this many high-profile, serious candidates, you want something to be your Trump card, which isn't Donald Trump yet, but you want something to be your Trump card that's going to break you through the pack.
Well,
Is stuff like this, Brad Chambers?
I think it obviously helps him. It looks like it. I assume they'll do a cost analysis of how much per job it costs us, but it looks like it's a good thing for Indiana. But wasn't Suzanne Crouch also the lieutenant governor during this period of time?
She absolutely is.
Isn't this part of her? I'm sure that Brad Chambers would share credit with her for that. I'm sure, right?
Well, this actually brings me perfectly to my question that I wanted to ask you. Yeah, thank you for that transition.
That's okay.
It's almost like we planned it, but we actually didn't. Suzanne Crouch is trying to walk this very fine line where she is absolutely part of the Holcomb administration and takes credit for things, good things that the Holcomb administration has done and things that she has also worked on as part of that administration, like particularly mental health care. But she's also been, hasn't shied away from criticizing things that Governor Holcomb has done when she's disagreed with them, saying, I know I'm part of the administration, but I wouldn't have done this. Is that too fine a line to walk?
I guess we'll see. I mean, she's going to continue to do it from now till primary election. I thought it was, my initial reaction was it was interesting that she wasn't out there touting this announcement at all, and Brad Chambers was. But then I thought, well, I don't know. Like, I kind of get, like, she is trying to distance herself from the Holcomb administration, even though she is a part of it, as we all know. And if you think about who the primary voters are they super excited about electric vehicles? Are they super excited about a record-breaking incentive and tax dollars being spent to get this project?
We'll have to talk about that.
I mean, there are things where I can see, like, where opponents would you know, find negatives to point out in campaign ads. So, you know, but, yeah, I think she's just going to continue to do it, and we'll see if it works for her or not.
I'll circle back to the original question with you, which is this a winner? Is this a categorical winner for Brad Chambers?
Can I go back to my last answer where I said traditionally one would think that this would be a winning strategy and would be a feather in his cap, and precedent in history would suggest that. To echo what I said a moment ago, the rules have changed. We got a flavor of this last week where there was, we saw the potential of a wedge issue entering into the race. You brought it up, was it last week?
Yeah.
When we talked about the LEAP project, the development that the state wants to make sure that everything is in place, including ample amounts of water, even if it's brought from someplace else. And we saw how Republican primary candidates are starting to pick sides there, presumably to tap into this sort of undercurrent of populism or anti-establishmentarianism, or if it's good for corporate America, it must be bad for us little guys and little gals, that sort of. And again, it depends on who's motivated to vote on election day in the primary. It's certainly, to go back to what I said, one would think that a good job announcement is a good thing. Yeah. So I guess I'll go with history a little bit longer until it proves me wrong again.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, will the announcement of a second electric vehicle battery plant in Indiana help recent Indiana Commerce Secretary Brad Chambers' bid for governor? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you whether Democrats should have helped keep Kevin McCarthy in the U.S. House speakership. 30% of you say yes, 70% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana received $3 million from the federal government to develop a plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports the State Department of Environmental Management held the first of several statewide public meetings this week on the issue in Indianapolis.
Some of the projects the agency is considering include ways to expand clean energy, improve energy efficiency, increase electric vehicle use, expand access to public transit, and reduce food waste. About 40 cities in Indiana already have or are working on climate action plans. Shannon Anderson works with cities and youth activists through the nonprofit Earth Charter Indiana. She says it's important that the state fund and serve the communities already doing this work.
And I think moving some of that work back into our communities not only helps build equity and resilience, but it also helps serve people.
Several participants expressed concern the state might prioritize big companies and institutions that can more easily apply for funding. Anderson says the state should also consider projects that make solar more available to schools, which can empower disadvantaged communities.
Josh Wanis, is there a reason for Hoosiers to be skeptical of what the state ends up doing?
There will be people who are skeptical. Clearly, the state's trying to allay those concerns with the hearings, with trying to solicit input from a cross-section of the state of Indiana. But there will be those critics. You know, this is not the big-ticket debate, though. I mean, this is the non-competitive grants that were awarded here as part, I think it's about $250 million overall, as part of a $5 billion emissions or clean air sort of initiative that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act at the federal level. So what's to come once the states put forth their plans and submit their plans would be the competitive phase of this, which is worth upwards of, well, do the math, $4.6 or $7 billion dollars. And that's where the proof, that's the pudding where the proof will emerge about whether skeptics should cheer this as a sincere move on the part of Indiana environmental forces within the state of Indiana, or whether it's just some sort of way to placate critics.
There are folks who obviously are skeptical of anything the state does when it comes to environmental management, because Indiana doesn't exactly have a good record of that for the last forever. But the specific concerns that I was curious about was this idea that even if the state is going to do the right thing here and put the money where it's going to help, is it going to only put it in, for lack of a better term, the big boys, and not make sure that this is getting to the communities that don't get these sorts of efforts, environmental efforts, as often as they should?
Well, I think that goes to the skepticism that we'll probably see around that, and I think we've already seen. That's certainly a concern. I think the one thing I'd be watching for is what happens. Okay, so they create this plan, right? But what happens to implement the plan? And, like, that's going to depend a lot on, I would imagine, who our next governor is, as we were just discussing, and who our next governor puts in charge of IDEM. There's going to be a totally new administration, and I think looking at the candidates who are running, that could go a lot of different ways. And to your question, whether or not it just goes to the big boys, like, again, I think depends on who our next governor is and who the head of IDEM is.
Yeah, these meetings, obviously we got the money to do these meetings, but these meetings are important, they're good, but to a certain extent, do they kind of not matter until we know who's going to be in charge after 2024?
Well, it depends on how fast they come out with the plan. I mean, it's one thing to leave it open-ended to the next governor. It's another one to have a plan in place that you're submitting to the federal government, and you may be somewhat corralled in despite your animosity towards clean air, as we've seen from some of our candidates on the Republican side. They may feel an obligation to spend the money. So I think that timing is important on this, and I want to see what the state comes up with.
When it comes to the campaign itself for governor, environmental issues don't often get a lot of attention in Indiana. For whatever reason, voters don't often go to the ballot box with those issues in mind. It's jobs and education and
inflation
and sometimes abortion. But we're now seeing real money on the table when it comes to environmental issues. Real federal money, the EV plant is not entirely separate from the idea of environmental.
Directly connected to it.
Yeah. So when you're talking now about billions and billions of dollars being at play, is this something that candidates are going to have to more directly speak to than they've had to in the past?
Well, I mean, that's not that part of the EV plant wasn't highlighted, right?
No.
Why it's being built, because right. There is this push and this consumer demand for electric vehicles and cleaner energy and all these things. I think the state legislature a couple years ago, Representative Saladay passed this framework for carbon sequestration, so large-scale manufacturers and producers could sequester carbon. So there are things that the legislature has done in recent years, but also, we have a lot of solar developers that are trying to build in the state, and the state 2 years ago tried to pass minimum standards so that, a town council or a board of zoning appeals that's full of unelected people can't come in and block these things, which they're doing all the time.
Yeah. Right.
So there are things the legislature could do to encourage this private industry that's already going that way.
Yeah,
just get out of their way.
It's not interfering in the market. It's actually making sure that the market
fair.
Is open
Can I,
and
yeah.
fair.
But the other part of that, too, it may not have been at the forefront of a lot of people's mind when they go to vote, but in the younger generation, it really, really matters.
Yes.
And it's really not an issue to your question about why this is not a higher profile in Indiana. It isn't generally, but when it is, it comes roaring onto the scene. Marble Hill, the Indiana's,
garbage.
Which would have been Indiana's nuclear facility. Then you had the whole debate over out-of-state trash during the Biden administration. So there are times when it does become a big issue. It's not like some states. We're not California. We're not other states where there's a heightened sensitivity 365 days a year.
All right. Well, until recently, this is a little related, Indiana received the second lowest amount of funding per person from the Inflation Reduction Act and the Federal Infrastructure Law. That's according to a report by Atlas Public Policy. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports the state could be catching up.
As of last month, Indiana has now secured more than $450 million, or $66 per person. While it may sound like a lot, neighboring Kentucky and Michigan received about twice as much. Annabelle Rosser is a senior policy analyst at Atlas Public Policy. She says it can be hard for some state agencies to find the staff time to apply for or implement this funding, and grant writing is a complicated process. Fortunately, she says there are resources to help, and there's still time. Only about a fifth of the federal funding for climate programs has been awarded.
So there's also still ample opportunity for communities in the state agencies to continue to take advantage of these funds.
The Indiana Office of Management and Budget says the state is working to evaluate which grants to pursue and has applied for some that haven't been awarded yet.
Now, Lindsay, we got news this morning in Indiana that the Midwest Alliance that Indiana is a part of is one of the winners of the hydrogen hubs that is part of all of this federal legislation. That's a huge win for Indiana, something the state cited as saying, hey, we are working on this to get this number up. Is that unquestionably good news, or are there still politics at play?
I think it's good news. I mean, to the politics question, we saw Senator Todd Young and Representative Mervan send out a joint statement together. So that is some real bipartisanship.
Yes,
both of
is.
Them are happy about it. I think that says a lot.
Yeah. All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody of Axios Local. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.